G'day, mate. How you going? This is Adam O'Brien, and welcome to Fandom Podcast Network, here where we enjoy all forms of fandom. Well, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, I bring you Lethal Mullet Podcast, an Australian look at B-grade action films from the 1980s. That's right, going back to that beloved time when we had Chuck Norris on almost every Friday night here in Australia, kicking, punching, and shooting his way to the top, alongside Jean-Claude Van Damme, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the likes of many of the others that came after him. Sylvester Stallone. We even look at some of the heroes you may not know, all here on one Fortnightly podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can check it out also on Podbean if you've got the Podbean app. Make sure you check it out. Now, let's get into the episode here on Fandom Podcast Network. Welcome to Lethal Mullet Podcast, live here on Fandom Podcast Network, your place from fandom for all ends of the universe. I've got to tell you, we are in for a hell of a treat tonight because we're going to be heading into a universe that we don't often chat about, I think, in action movies as such here. But I tell you what, we're going to go from all ends of the spectrum in this one, particularly because it's about Stephen King. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, the Lethal Mullet himself. And joining me on the other side of the world is the amazing pal of mine who we usually chat Star Wars. But I tell you what, we're chatting about a universe that we both are so passionate about. Now, I want you all to welcome the amazing Sander DeLange. You may know him from TK421, but I tell you what, also StarWars.com for the amazing blogs that he does on there. And I tell you what, StarWars.com, why don't you please do us all a favour and give him some more time to do blogs on the website, because I miss them and we, as Star Wars fans, miss them too. Sander, how are you?
Oh, excellent. That's really way too much honour that you gave me there. I mean, yeah, I really loved doing the StarWars.com job, and I'm happy to have found a place now also with Pentatrax, writing about the really underrated Star Wars Phantom Menace. But yeah, we're here today to talk about Stephen King, which actually not many people know about me, but that's my second fandom. It's Star Wars and then Stephen King. I really have to read all the novels, see all the movies, have his soundtracks, comics, everything really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still haven't found a way yet to listen to the radio station that he is a DJ on. Otherwise, I would have listened to that too, but one day I will find a way to do that.
It's amazing that he has a love of all kinds of music. I mean, he likes his rock and roll, obviously, but I think that permeates in a lot of the stories. We do get music in those stories. One of the great ones, obviously, in The Stand itself at the start with the Captain Trips part, we get that. Now, yep. You can see it in the miniseries. You know, a lot of that sort of translates through. But he's a fan of many other things himself. I only found out the other day that he's a huge fan of Jack Reacher.
Ah, well, I haven't seen or read any of Jack Reacher just yet, but it wouldn't surprise me. Because, I mean, as you said, he's a fan of many things. I mean, if you just read the Dark Tower novels, for example, how many things he referenced in that. Oh, I mean, yeah. Harry Potter is in there. I mean, seriously, Harry Potter. I mean, who would have thought that Stephen King would reference the
book? It really is. It's such an amazing series, The Dark Tower, where, you know, a lot of fans probably don't know out there that aren't familiar with the series itself. The Dark Tower really brings together the entire bibliography of Stephen King.
Exactly. Yeah, that's basically our first MCU before we had an MCU. That's why I love Castle Rock so much, the series that we had one season up, and I'm thinking they're doing a second one, but it really does tie everything together there.
It really does. And I think one of the great things about it is you read one story and then you get a little link, you know, whether it's you're reading The Dark Tower and you get a little link to Salem's Lot or, you know, whatever it is, you know, these great stories.
The one to Salem's Lot, that wasn't a small link. I mean, the novel was a whole sequel to Salem's Lot for Father Kellen. Yeah, Kellen.
It's brilliant. I mean, that's the great thing about these books is that one leads to another. And, of course, we've got heroes and villains and, of course, side characters, which, you know, you're always going to find here and there. I mean, let's face it, it's like the Star Wars universe to some extent. We have the Crimson King. We have Randall Flagg, the Walking Dude. I mean, these amazing characters.
Yeah, and that's really is the beauty of all the Stephen King novels. You can start with any of them. Well, not if you pick one of the Dark Tower ones, but I mean, if you're going to read Dark Tower 3, for example, right away, don't do it. But basically, any of his novels can read as a standalone. But if you really have read them all, you see so many connections, which is quite a shame that the movies don't quite do that yet, because how great they have been lately. I mean, we have gotten quite some good ones, and we'll be talking about the 80s ones in a moment. But yeah, all the modern ones, they really should try to reference each other a little bit more. I think
so too. I mean, let's talk about our introduction to Stephen King. I think the first thing that I saw of Stephen King was The Shining. And this is before I'd even read a book of his work. And The Shining, as a kid, scared me a little bit. You know, I didn't know quite what was going to happen to you. And he says, axe coming through the door, and here's Johnny. You know, like that's what I knew of it.
Which
and,
was even in a novel. Yeah. Greatest scene of the book, and let's just a funny coincidence, because I was watching at the list, and it actually turns out that the Shining was actually the first adaptation in the 80s that came out.
Oh, wow.
Only one movie came out earlier, that was Carrie in 1967,
mm-hmm.
which makes sense that it's the first novel is also the first movie. But right after that came The Shining already from Stanley Kubrick.
It's amazing.
What's
great about that too is, folks, if you like The Shining, just wait for the ending of the theatrical run of Blade Runner, where you get to see more Shining.
You did?
Yeah, you certainly did. It was the footage that you see of the car leading up to the hotel, the outlook up there.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Ridley ran out of footage, and Ridley said to Stanley, can I use some of that footage from the Shining? He said, mate, I've got hours of that aerial footage. Use it however you want.
Yeah, true.
And I think he got one snippet of Harrison Ford going, Deckard, Blade Runner, you know, and it was him, right, we're going to go off into the sunset. And then it would pull back. Showed all that footage.
Yeah. But we have to be honest. Well, the movie The Shining is a good one.
Yes.
In itself, it's good. But it's not the best of the Stephen King adaptations.
No,
they changed so much. And, I mean, we all know that Stephen King himself wasn't that happy with it himself.
That's correct. That's true.
To put it mildly, actually, but I'm pretty sure the things that he really did say, we can't repeat here for maybe the youngest artist name, but
oh, I have to 100% agree. What I think is the best adaptations are the ones you don't expect. The Mist, for example.
Which actually has a better ending than the original short story, I think. Because the short story just patters out a little bit. It's like the guy finds some notes, and then no notes left or something like that. So it really is a bit of an... it fizzles out. Not that big of an ending. It's... Well, of course, the movie has the monster walking by and stuff like that. I mean, yeah, it was a movie, yeah.
And it's a gripping ending. The movie it sort of captures you. You know, you're kind of like, wow. You know, like you don't see it coming.
Not at all. No, not at all. And of course, a great role by Thomas Jane.
Oh yes.
Before, actually, no, it was after I discovered it as Punisher already.
Yeah, it would have been after Punisher was 2004.
True.
Mm. Now,
yeah.
I have to.
Yeah,
The Shining.
Well, I do wonder now, because we know that we are getting Doctor Sleep this year or next year. I'm not quite sure when it will be released, but yeah, I wonder how much they will tie it to the Kubrick one, or just tie it to the book and everything that's different that they just leave in the middle or not. I really wonder how they will play that up.
It'll be interesting. Like, and how do you cast this film? Do you follow with the Torrance idea, or do you, you know, with Nicholson obviously cast as the father, who would you cast in this new film?
Yeah, because there are probably flashbacks coming anyway in Shining.
Yeah.
So yeah, and they're basically wondering what the hell will they show of it? Will be more the Kubrick Hotel or more the miniseries hotel or just something in the middle I think they basically just do it in the middle stuff like that. All the big hits of the movie probably will be referenced somehow, but
because I mean Spielberg's just referenced it recently in a certain partly animated film.
Yes, Ready Player One. I find it such a shame that it was spoiled for me by the Dutch TV.
Oh, really?
Because yeah, it was because they really wanted to keep it a surprise. Spielberg.
Yeah.
There's basically he rewrote all the tests to get to the egg.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he rewrote everything just for the ones that read the book that they will be surprised by the movie.
Oh wow!
And they can figure out the clues along with characters.
I'm just waiting for the sequel, Ready Player 2.
Yes, of course. Of the prequel, Ready Player Zero.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. What's interesting, I think the writer even wrote an homage to the Starfighters and stuff like that with Armada, which I've checked out, and it wasn't too bad.
Yes. Well, actually, I like the novel really a lot too, but that was really more game focused, I think.
Yeah,
even the game references and stuff like that, and a bit of vague anime stuff and role playing.
Yeah,
I was like, yeah, I get why Spielberg made it a bit more pop culture.
Yeah, and obviously a little bit of Star Wars references here and there.
Well, quite a few of them, actually. I mean, I was even surprised that Ewok movies were referenced in the novel of Ready Player One.
Yeah, I think even our pal Eric Walker, Mace Tawani himself, even had a bit of a look at that too. When he heard it, wow, they're actually referencing my movie.
Yes.
Just,
yeah.
It's amazing. Oh, well, that's it. Now, folks, tonight we're going to be talking about, obviously, the adaptations of some of these great books. And I think one of the things is they haven't quite hit their stride. And I think one of the recent ones, obviously The Dark Tower, didn't quite set it alight. And unfortunately for us, you know, as the fans, we weren't happy.
Not completely, no. I mean, there are still things I can like about The Dark Tower, mm-hmm. for example. But Stephen King movies has always been a hit and or miss.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been talking about the 1980s one. There are 14 movies released in the 1980s, and a whole bunch of them are by big names. At the beginning, we had, Carrie in 1967, Brian De Palma,
yep.
Stanley Kubrick, The Shining, 1980, Creepshow, George A. Romero. also a legend, let's be honest.
Oh, definitely.
We have Dead, David Cronenberg, Christine, John Carpenter, Rob Reiner, Stand By Me, The Running Man with Schwarzenegger, Pet Sematary, another classic. They're really, it started off so well.
Yeah.
So I really is curious to see how we went from there to movies like The Dark Tower, which was Dreamcatcher was also Hearts of Atlantis.
Hearts of Atlantis.
Also, I mean, Hearts of Atlantis basically is the same, I think, like The Shining. Good movie, not a good adaptation.
Yeah, it strays too far from the story, I think.
Yeah.
It really does. And I think that's one of the things people didn't realise when they go back to those. I mean, there's even adaptations like Cujo, for example, you know, that aren't quite what they have. I mean, it's not just about, he doesn't just make horror stories. He makes character pieces, you know. We get into the characters, we get into the locations. And I think that's what he does. He sucks us into these stories through relating to people that talk like us, that live like us. You know, and they live around the culture that we have, whether it's the pop culture or the TV or the film. That's how he brings us in.
Exactly. Yeah, he completely does. And of course, with some of the movies, I'm really busy trying to reread all the novels that I haven't read yet of Stephen King, and also the older ones that he published in the 60s and 70s and all that. And really, there are a lot of references that I'm like, sure, way before my time. And I can imagine that for movies, they have to change that or cut that out completely. I mean, with It, they even moved it to an entire different decade for most of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
It is truly amazing, isn't it?
So, there aren't really any adaptations that are really 100% faithful, but some they really change for the better and some for the worse. But I think that's normal anyway for books, but especially with ones for Stephen King.
Oh, without a doubt. So let's start with some of the early ones. So obviously 1980 with The Shining, which is an amazing, I think, setting. Locations were fantastic. And I think obviously the cast, great as well. But what I think about this series, this film in particular, is it like Blade Runner did with Do Android Dream the Electric Sheep, they stray quite a bit from the story and build their own universe.
Yeah, they really did. And I know, that's basically it, what you said. I mean, I like the movie. I really like music, the opening scene. I mean, beautiful. I mean, often enough when I drive to work, well, drive my bike, but I just like to put that on and imagine myself actually going to I'm having a blackout. What's the name of the hotel again? The Outlook, right?
Yeah, Outlook, yeah.
Because for those who are listening and who don't know it, I work in a hotel. So basically, I'm still hoping to catch a dead woman in 324. But
let's face it, there's some iconic scary moments in that film.
Yes, I mean, it's also scary how ugly that hotel is inside.
Oh yeah,
I mean that the carpet, the green tiles in the bathroom. I mean, my lord.
It's like a 1950s hotel that never aged, you know, like it just stayed where it was.
Yes. Well, actually, and it is quite fitting for the story.
Well, it's true, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
It left also, so why should the hotel have left?
But I think they take a lot of liberties. If you fast forward to 1987, we have one of the cast members of Starsky and Hutch directs Richard Bachman's The Running Man, and Gorn are the hunters in that book, which just have hunting rifles, and they're hunting down Ben Richards. And I think there's something about the way that he does the ticking down of the clock through that story is just so well done, which you usually get that with The Regulators, if I remember right. It's always in that sort of two-pack back in the day in paperback. But, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger comes in and he has all these muscular, huge, massive wrestlers and stuff like that trying to hunt him down, and they turned it into a TV show.
Yes. Man, what one of those bleak looks at what the future would bring and could bring. it really was a campy story, you know, the way they showed it. I mean, the costume design and stuff like that. I mean, I probably think that if any of our listeners who haven't seen it yet and will think after this podcast, oh, let's have a look. And they should, because it's still a good movie and a good story. But I think they will be horrified by the costume design.
Yeah, it's quite out there, even for the time. It was different.
Yes. Yeah, different is a good word. But that also reminds me, because we had a similar story of Stephen King, The Long Walk.
Oh, yes.
Which was just a lot of people just walking for days on end. They get three warnings when the speed drops down a certain miles per hour, or when they stand still and stuff like that. And they get three warnings, and the third warning is a bullet to the head.
And it's scary. These are teenage kids.
With teenage kids, yeah. Way before the Hunger Games, way before the other story that the Hunger Games probably ripped off from, Battle Royale,
that's right, the Japanese story, yeah, 100%. Yes.
But The Long Walk, it's still one of my favorite novels, and we still haven't gotten a proper adaptation of that one yet.
No, did they ever do a TV movie of that? Was there a TV? I can't remember.
Not at all. No TV movie, no comic, nothing. And it was like 1979 book came out.
And that was a tense story. Quite a lot of pressure in that story.
Oh, it was. And really an ambiguous ending, too, with the guy just walking off. Even after he won, he kept walking, and he sees some kind of shape in the distance. And, yeah, you really can discuss for days on end if it's either the person who shuts the people down with the warnings about to shoot him down, or if he is already dead and that he's basically just walking in a tunnel towards God or the devil or whatever you want. So stuff like that. That really is, for me, a great ending. Oh. You're left wondering. I mean, it's still a proper ending. The story ends for sure. And yet, you can still imagine what really is the ending or not. Why probably it would be terrible to make in a movie, because you can't really end like that.
Because you'd be guessing. You'd be continuing to guess, is this going to continue, or is there another scene to come after the credits or something?
That's true. So they probably just end with... Probably in getting a third shot, I guess, then, but who knows?
You know, who
knows?
One of the great things about Stephen King is that he doesn't just write, obviously he's known as a horror writer. I think that's the big part that was, you know, he's known about thrillers, horrors as his main genre, especially with Carrie and obviously with The Shining. But what's interesting is it's a lot of his roles.
I don't think even Carrie is a horror. That's a teen drama story.
Actually, you're right, isn't it? It really is. At its heart, that's what that story is. I even think, I will question this. I will say even it might be a horror to a certain extent, but I think that's actually a bit more of a teen drama / comedy in parts.
Yeah, you make a good point. Yeah.
Because let's face it, Pennywise is funny. He's not just scary.
But the thing with it is, and there's a whole bunch of movies like that, it's really a coming together of and a coming of age story for kids.
Like Stand By Me.
If you just look at the list of the 1980s movies that we're going to be talking about, and so we have a few of them there too, like Stand By Me. That's also Christine, in a way, also a lot of the teen people about to graduate and move on in life.
It's very true.
So, yeah. Children of Corn, the whole bunch of trying to make it in the world. that's stretching it.
It really is.
There really are some of his best works. Who does that? As you said, it, and of course, and I think when I look at the 1980s movies, I think Stand By Me is one of the best for me because coming of age. Story and the beautiful cast.
It really, it's a strong story. I think, and the fact that we now see where a lot of those actors have gone to, you know, afterwards, you know, it's one of those great casts that you go, wow, I can look back on that and think, I know where those actors have gone to.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it has Will Wheaton, River Phoenix, Corey Feldman, Jerry O'Connell. Well, we can all easily name what they all did afterwards. Jerry O'Connell, Sliders, River Phoenix, was in Indiana Jones. Will Wheaton, Well, Hello, Star Trek, Big Bang.
That's right. Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah. And Corey Feldman. Corey Feldman doesn't do that much anymore, I think.
Yeah. I think he's doing music now.
Yeah, and of course he was he was in Goonies also, right?
Yeah, and he was in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles as Donatello.
Really?
Yeah, he did the voice. Yeah.
I mean, I knew those old turtle movies, but I didn't realize he was one of them. He was Donatello.
Yeah, because I remember. He was
my favorite, because I always liked Donatello the best.
He was great. And I like at the start how they're going, excellent, bodacious. And he goes, Chevy Nova? They were great times.
But they even referenced that more or less in the recent Batman and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles crossover.
Oh, wow. Now, you must tell us, is this good? Because I haven't seen it yet and I haven't read the comic either.
It's interesting, let me tell you that. I like it.
Batman
like
versus it. The Shredder.
But I mean, it's a bit of a crazy thing to imagine that Gotham and New York basically is a one-hour drive away, but but then again, it always was, but yeah. And of course, let's not forget that Stand By Me also has a really good, villain. I mean, they have some rival kids that were older and basically pissed off at them. That's what big kids are, I guess. And one of them was played by the great Kiefer Sutherland.
Oh, yes. Now, I can't remember, was this just before The Lost Boys or was it after The Lost Boys?
Because
I think that was 87, I think. I can't remember.
Stand By Me was 86.
Yeah, so it might have been just before The Lost Boys, where he played the vampire.
Yeah, true. Yeah, because for me, I saw Kiefer Sutherland, I think, for the first time in 24.
Mm-hmm.
Great series. And then I didn't even knew that he was in Stand By Me when I put Stand By Me on during one of my many Stephen King watches.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, what? The blonde kid? Is that Porsche, IMDb? I'll be damned. That is Kiefer Sutherland. I mean, he really... I mean, as we grow older, even especially boys, we really change in the way we look. But he didn't. I mean,
yeah, he said the same.
Still see his older self in the young version in Stand By Me.
He's great. And he did that, I think, a year after that, Young Guns. If you've ever seen Young Guns, that's a great film.
I'll have to put it on my list because I'm not sure I've seen that one yet.
It's a good little Western, that one, and it has a lot of actors that go on to do huge films and huge careers afterwards.
All right. I'll have to keep that in mind.
Definitely. Now, folks, if you're listening tonight, we are now going to be going through a list that Sanders compiled, which, of course, is going to give us the films. Some of the great ones, some that probably stray way too far from Stephen King's story, but we're going to look at the Stephen King adaptations of the 1980s and give you a bit of our thoughts on those. So we've talked about The Shining, so we might jump forward a bit. What was the next adaptation that you have on the list there that you think would be great to chat about?
Well, actually, that's already the next one. There will be 1982, The Creepshow.
The
director George A. Romero.
Oh, wow.
With the short stories Weeds and The Craves.
Now, this is a movie I saw on cable channel years ago. I haven't actually seen it on DVD. I saw this on basically cable only. And I've got to say...
Revealing your age.
Yes, yes, certainly am. Certainly not screaming, that's for sure. Not screaming.
don't worry. I'm a few movies down the line, I will be revealing my age.
Ned, what did you think of this amazing old film?
I have to be totally honest. There are a few movies of the 1980s I haven't seen yet. Both creep shows are included.
Oh, wow. Okay, there you go. So Sander has to check these out and let us know what his thoughts are.
But I am really curious. I mean, it's George A. Romero, who is really a legend also in horror movies,
yes,
with Nights of the Living Dead and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I am really curious about what he made of the Stephen King adaptations.
Especially with a name in horror like that.
Yes, exactly. So basically the two greats come together. It must be amazing.
I'm
watching a little bit further down the list, the 1987
mm-hmm.
Creepshow 2. But then it had a different director, Michael Gornick.
It's not a name I'm familiar with.
Well, why did that happen? Any idea or?
Not sure. I think like a lot of the sequels that they've done to, you know, like, you know, Children of the Corn, things like that, they start out with, you know, a bigger name.
But they can be basically ignored because Stephen King had zero involvement in basically any sequels with an original story.
That's right.
I mean, but Creepshow 2 did have the short story The Raft adapted. And Raft is one of my favorite short stories.
It's a great story. It really is.
It is, and it is quite simple. It's just basically, I get a bunch of kids, sit during a summer break, summer holiday, I think it was.
That's right.
Sitting on a raft in the middle of a lake, unable to get out because the creepy water creature alien thingy it was.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's done it a few times, that dream catcher, a little bit too there, with the grey.
Yes. Mm. So, but I do hope that this one is better than dream catcher.
Oh,
one,
yeah, yeah, it is.
I mean, the book was great. I really liked that whole... Mind Palace stuff that the Sherlock later used. Well, actually, I'm pretty sure that Sherlock didn't steal it from Dreamcatcher because it's a real psychology thing, the Mind Palace. But that's basically Dreamcatcher was for me the introduction to Mind Palaces. Mm. And then I really liked it. trouble.
Oh, it's great, isn't it? And the book, obviously, one of the great lines, which I still use today, when things are really boring at work and stuff, I go, SSDD.
Exactly. Same shit, different day.
And the thing is, one thing I loved about that film, not so much the story, I think they didn't quite crack it, but the cast was quite good. They worked really well together.
Yeah, I'm surprised that for such a good cast, the movie turned out what it was.
Mm.
It must have been either directing or script that was flawed like hell, but...
I think the editing...
Morgan Freeman returned to Stephen King movies with that movie.
Yeah, he certainly did, yeah. Oh, brilliant.
We all know and love him as Rhett in Shawshank Redemption.
That's right.
Which wasn't a 1980s movie also. No,
1994.
94,
yeah. One of his best.
For the next podcast.
Yeah, we'll do that in the 90s one. So what comes after Creepshow on your list?
Then we get the three movies in 1983. All three excellent ones. Cujo, The Dead Zone, and Christine.
Oh, wow. Yes. Now, these are brilliant. These are classics. And these are ones that you find a lot on free-to-air channels in the middle of the night, particularly Christine and Cujo because of the horror elements. But
yeah.
I have to say, The Dead Zone is probably my favorite out of the picks.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. Yeah, but that's the more original of the three when it comes to the story.
It is. And it's different. Again, obviously, we've got an actor who pretty much takes over the movie here. Walken. Yeah, definitely. I think it's very much in the way that Jack Nicholson did in his Jack Torrance and... obviously in The Shining, it's slightly different to the King story, but I think at the same time, it's its own little universe.
It is. Yeah, because honestly, I don't even remember who were the cast in Cujo and Christine.
Mm.
And looking here, Christine had Harry Dean Stanton in it.
Well, that's because of John Carpenter, of course, because he was very good friends with John Carpenter after doing Escape from New York.
But Christine really has the best ending of all movies for me.
You think?
Well, with the car being slowly assembled in the assembly line and rolling out of the factory and stuff like that, with the beautiful song Bad to the Bone from George Thorogood.
Yes. Oh, he was great.
That's just a almost perfect beginning. Completely perfect would have been if somewhere along the montage, some kind of accident happened with someone working on the car. Then it would have been even better. Just show the evil was there from the beginning.
It was always there. It was bring the vehicle, you know, like it's going to happen, you know.
Yeah.
I always think there's elements of that.
But then again, then we would have complained probably because it wasn't in a novel. Because the novel, I think, had the car only later possessed by the ghost of one of its owners went apes.
Here's what's interesting. Here's where I think the elements of not only the Dark Tower, but Dr. Sleep and The Shining come in, we know the characters have the shine.
Yes. That is,
the Force.
Yep, the Force indeed. It really does bind everything together.
Mm.
Even a different movie universe.
I mean, even look at the recent Dark Tower, they even talk about that, how, Roland himself says, some of these characters have the shine. You've got it. When you tap into it, it's a little bit like Lord of the Rings, I suppose, when Frodo touches the One Ring and uses it. Sauron can straight away catch where he is.
Indeed. Yeah. But when we're talking about the cast, I'm actually surprised by the cast of Cujo also.
Mm.
Because one of the big roles is basically the kids and the mom who got trapped in the car.
Yeah.
And the mom was Dee Wallace.
Oh, serious?
The mom.
I didn't even remember that.
The mom, yeah. The mother of Elliot in E.T.
Oh, wow. Now, that is small world.
Yes. Well, she probably, I mean, E.T. was also 1980-something, right?
Yeah, 1982.
Yeah. So basically, she did E.T. and then she went on to Cujo.
Wow. Now, that really is small world. That's amazing. Now, out of those films, I think for me, the Christopher Walken's performance in the Dead Zone's what really sticks out for me, because it really is chewing up all the scenery. He's taking all the camera's literally just hugging him.
Yes. Yeah, but he's a scene stealer in most of the movies anyway. I mean, he's that good an actor.
Oh, he is. And he's very entertaining. Now, what is next on your list there for 80s adaptations that you like?
Well, the next year, 1984, had two movies, Children of the Corn and Firestarter.
Yes.
I have to talk of Firestarter for a moment, because we mentioned Christine had the mother, yeah. Dee Wallace. Firestarter had the daughter.
Ah, yes, Drew Barrymore. Yes.
Still as a little kid.
Yeah, I have to admit something. I always thought Caravan of Courage had Eric Walker and Drew Barrymore. For years in the 80s.
Yeah, I can see why you say that. Because, yeah, they do look similar.
It's reminiscent, yeah, it's in the years. What did you think of Firestarter?
It was an enjoyable one. I mean, it had some great locations. I mean, as you really know, I love shooting locations. I visit those. I mean, they had those. And that's really the scene that always stands out to me. It's a really simple scene of, I think it was the father who was going to send some letters away at the post office. And just where he does it was your basic American street with post office, general store, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And completely on the other side of the street, there were these really cool rock formations, which turned out some kind of national park. And that always stood out as one of those amazing locations that I really have to go to one day. And yeah, the movie itself, it's an enjoyable one, but I'm not sure if it's one of the best. And
what about Children of the Corn?
The very first one?
Yeah, the
excellent.
Very first. Yeah, and it really
all
is.
Sequels, I mean, they've made like 5 or 6 sequels of them by now, of Children of the Corn, 7 maybe?
I think there's about 6 at least, yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, I stopped watching after the second or the third, I think.
They're a little bit like the Police Academy sequels. They just get worse and worse.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they really did. They really did.
And what's the next film after Children of the Corn and obviously that film that strikes a mark?
Then we get a couple of my birth year, 1985.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit, I'm not quite sure if I read or watched any of them. It was Cat's Eye,
yes,
which adapted the short stories Quitters Inc. and The Ledge.
Mm-hmm.
And Silver Bullets, which was based on the novella Cycle of the Werewolf. Now, I know I've read Cycle of the Werewolf,
mm-hmm,
because, well, they say novella, but it was really a whole bunch of illustrations with just a little bit of story.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And that's, it's a basic werewolf story. Not one of his best, I think. I mean,
yeah, it's a bit generic, I think.
Yeah. I mean, he did a lot better in other movies.
Oh, I think so too. But
one more thing about Firestarter, and that's why I really have to read the novel as soon as possible, because this year we are getting a sequel of sorts with The Institute, with the novel.
Oh, wow.
They're basically all about the shop.
That's right.
That they created Drew Barrymore to be a Firestarter and stuff like that. So I really want to read those as if some kind of theology, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that'd be fantastic. A little bit like The Shining and Dr. Sleep. They gel together so well.
Yes, it does. Chimney Rock, by the way, was the location of where they are mailing the letters. There's a bridge with those really nice rock formations next to it.
Oh, fantastic. Just look.
Oh, yeah. The next movie is also a bit of a generic one, Maximum Overdrive.
Oh, I liked that movie. That was a good movie.
Yeah, it's a good movie, but I saw it either before or right after Duel of Steven Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
It's really similar.
Yeah, it kind of, if you think about Maximum Overdrive, kind of is bang on Duel. Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it is the same feel.
So ruined my enjoyment a little bit, I think. Just too similar and seemed too short after each other. If I've seen it maybe a year before or a year after, I would have enjoyed it more, I think.
I've always thought that story's a little bit like there's a movie that Rutger Hauer did in the 80s, I think late 80s, and I think pulled a lot from that story, where he's, he's the Hitchhiker, it might be, I think it's called, where he's basically like a bounty hunter or something, if I remember it.
True. Mm. But the nice thing about Maximum Overdrive is that it was directed by King himself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he didn't do the directing a lot. I think it may be one of the only times I think he did.
Because Michael Crichton that too.
Going through the list quickly in my head, I'm like, yeah, I can't imagine what else he did.
So what's the next after Maximum Overdrive?
Well, the next three actually are ones that we already spoken a bit about.
Mm-hmm.
Stand By Me,
yep.
Creepshow 2, and The Running Man,
yeah. And
yeah,
that would bring us to, I think, 1988. What's in 1988?
1989, because there weren't any in 1988. So mm-hmm. We're already in the last year, and the last adaptation for the 1980s, Pet Sematary.
Oh, wow, yes. So I love that.
We end on a high note.
Pet Sematary was a fantastic movie. That was great. And the book's fantastic too. Scary though.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm not afraid of anything and stuff like that, but in general, I can see why people get scared about what they read or see, but it doesn't quite scare me. But this one really was, unnerving at times.
I think so. I think this is the closest.
It's really the one that the King himself often say that it's the scariest one for him also.
I can see that.
Yeah, but that's basically, and he really explained it well in the four words of the novel, that basically he said it has to deal with a kid being hit by the truck in the middle of the road, which is, of course, the nightmare for every parent. But that basically most of the story actually happens, or nearly happens, to Stephen King in real life with his son. I think it was Owen or Joe who got hit by the truck.
I think so.
I think it was Owen, because Owen is the youngest, right?
Yes, he is.
It's Joe, Amanda, and then it's Job, I think. But yeah, but basically that's so many things that when he talks about the real life story, you're like, all right, that's completely a copy of what happened. The Pet Cemetery really was there behind one of the houses he lived in, where indeed his son was nearly hit by a truck. And yeah, I can imagine why he didn't want the book ever to finish, to have it published, let alone be made a movie, I think.
Oh,
he must have dropped off some nasty memories for him too, I think.
Yeah, you can imagine, like, because I mean, I've got his On Writing, which shows his the way that he puts those together. And one of the great things is that he's like us; he's on the spur of the moment. So you're going to see spur of the moment things in the way that he does it. He's the same. He doesn't know what he's going to write next. There's no plan. It's an unscripted road.
Yeah, there's beauty.
I think he and George Martin write very similar that way.
Yes, they do.
Except Stephen King finishes his books.
Oh, yes. He just keeps on churning them out.
He does. He chews them up and spits them out, he does. It's just amazing. Now, obviously, we've been talking about the 80s adaptations, folks, today, and I would love to do another episode in the next couple of months where we move to the 90s adaptations, where I think they're a little bit more successful with getting King's will into the films.
Oh, I'm looking at a list now. The 90s were, I think, the golden age of the movies, when I look through them quickly.
You know, I think that they really it nailed down right up to the Green Mile, which I think the Green Mile is the pinnacle for me. I think it's... Shawshank was fantastic. Obviously, some other great 90s adaptations were fantastic. But The Green Mile sucks you in. It's a long film, but it's one that is very rewarding.
Yeah, I agree. But, yeah. Well, we'll delve into that one the next time. But let's talk a little bit more about Pet Cemetery.
Yes.
Did you saw the remake from this year? And what do you think?
Well, I haven't seen the remake yet. I've seen little bits and pieces, photos, and obviously a couple of ideas on what the film's really going to be taken from the books. I'm interested to see whether they can capture the scares that I got in reading the book more so than what I saw in the earlier 80s adaptation. I want to be really thrown out of my chair, sick, and scared of this. And I know they can do it because you look at the adaptations of things like It, which work quite well. Pennywise can be quite scary, even when he's being funny.
Yes, yes. But I have to admit, the remake of Pet Cemetery, they did a couple of things right, because it had Duodigo in it. I think that's one of those things that you mentioned from the book. It wasn't original.
Yes.
Because it is cut out a really big part of the difficult walk to get to the Pet Cemetery, well, the Mi'kmaq part of the cemetery. And yeah, they got that bit right. Yeah, of course, you've seen the trailer probably, so you know it's not the little son who died, but the daughter.
The daughter,
which is an interesting deviation. Doesn't change that much, to be honest. So the original wins there. But I really liked the ending, which was really a typical ending, because do you recall the ending of the original movie?
Not of the original, no. Bits and pieces of the film, because it's been so long ago. That's another one I haven't seen since Cable.
Yeah, but it was basically the son had died, the kid had died again, then the mother also died. And then he brought the mother back, and the movie ended with the mother hugging the dad, the father.
Ah, that's right.
That was basically the ending.
Yeah.
And you're still left wondering, because the daughter was still alive. And I think with the grandparents. So that was a really bit more Yeah, it was great. Love the ending. But the ending, the movie, they reference it and changed it a bit. I'm not going to spoil anything more than that, but they really made a great nod to the original ending of the movie.
Oh, yes, definitely.
But, and yeah, that's basically all I'm going to say about it. But I saw the ending and I was like, oh, yes, you got right. And when he got right, so I can understand why you changed some stuff in the middle. Some for the better, some for the worse, maybe. But that really showed to me that the director does know what he was doing.
Oh, without a doubt. Now, one more last question I'm going to ask you tonight is going to be Dark Tower orientated. But if you could pick out of your friends in fandom, whether it's in the Star Wars community or just friends that we have on Facebook, who would be in your quartet?
Nah. You, of course.
Yes.
Probably Stefan.
Yes.
Vistan, a German friend from Star Wars books. And I would be curious just to see what kind of role Mark Newbold would play in my quartet.
That's it. The numero uno fantha, Mark Newbold, and of course Stefan. There you go. That's your quartet. There you go.
But yeah.
I think, you know, folks, you've got to put to Stephen King the fact that he's got this wondrous universe. Even in more recent books like Under the Dome and even 11-22-63, which I think, again, is another very interesting what-if sort of story, we're still getting these great stories which throw you into worlds where you know these characters, you know them. You can go to a coffee shop and hear the same voices. They're all there thanks to the amazing work that he does. It really is. That's true, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, you mentioned recent books. Let's not forget, of course, the Mr. Mercedes trilogy, Mr. Mercedes, Finest Keepers, End of Watch.
Yes.
And I really, really enjoyed The Outsider, too.
Yeah, I haven't read that one yet, so that's worth checking out.
Yes, you should, because it does feature a character from the Mr. Mercedes trilogy.
Ooh. Okay, that's it. You've sold me. I'm going to have to check it out.
You'll find out.
Now, folks, you got to check out Sander online. Obviously, he's done a lot of work in the Star Wars community, but he's now doing a lot about movie locations and, of course, getting together a massive database, which, who knows, in the near future, you may see on a website where you're going to be able to check out movie locations from all over the world. So tell the folks a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, that's an idea that I've had for a couple of years now, because, of course, you have to get a big database first.
Mm-hmm.
I even discovered a few locations that you don't see that much online if you look movies up. And yeah, shooting locations always have been my passion. I mean, as you know, one of my first article series about StarWars.com was about the shooting locations.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, in April, we had Star Wars Celebration. We even had a panel with three other great people, two from Skywalking Through Neverland, and James Lloyd, who also, he's everywhere, also online. So official website also for one. And yeah, we had a panel about the shooting locations of Star Wars. We just had 45 minutes to cover a bunch of them and our experiences there. And yeah, we had such lovely audience. I mean, we were packed. The entire hall was full. I mean, it really sounds like bragging when I say this, and I really don't mean like that, because despite all this, I really am an honest, humble person, if you can say that about yourself. But there were like 680 people there. I'm like, I would have been happy with 50 already. But yeah, really, 680 people. So my dream, and luckily I shared that same dream with James, Richard, and Sarah, that we really should do something about shooting locations. That's that big database of me online, and maybe organize tours or a website or something we're still figuring out what to do with it, but we will do something with it. And I know for sure that every Stephen King movie that I'm watching currently, or will watch and have watched, I'm noting down everything interesting from the locations, put it also in the database, and it will be out there someday, somehow, hopefully this year. But yeah, and if not, if you hear this and you're like, ooh, I really love the Shawshank Redemption and I want to go to where it was filmed, do contact me, find me online. There will probably links included with this file when you're listening to it.
There will
do be. Contact me, and I will be more than happy just to help you plan your next holiday, be it to the Outlook Hotel, be it to Las Vegas to see Randall Flagg, or Boulder to be with Lady Abigail. But yeah, I'll go to the Dixie Pig in New York. Whatever you want. I can imagine you on it. There's so many beautiful locations.
That's right. Folks, you've got to go check it out. And again, we'll leave links for Sanders, obviously, work, but also where you can contact him to get in touch with all about locations, etc. And I can't thank you enough for coming on. And let's do this again in the next month or so we can go through the 90s. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, yes. The 90s will be a great year.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Great decade. Yeah.
It's going to be a lot of fun. And now our message to you, Stephen King, in the words of the Trash Can Man, my life for you. My life for you. So, folks, go and check out, obviously, all the great Stephen King adaptations that are out there in the 1980s. Enjoy what we've chatted about tonight, and we'll catch you next time on Lethal Mullet Podcast here on Phantom Podcast Network. Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal Podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal Podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.